Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman. The U.S. says the Syria crisis has reached a turning point. The crisis in Syria has reached a hinge point where decisions made in the near future could either end the war or define a very difficult set of choices for the future, according to U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. In a speech at the Munich Security Conference Saturday, Kerry said, "We hope this week can be a week of change." His speech to the global forum that focuses on security policy comes 2 days after the International Syria Support Group met on the sidelines of the conference and agreed on plans for a ceasefire in Syria and an expansion of humanitarian aid. The 17-nation group has been seeking options that will foster the resumption of UN-facilitated talks this month between the Syrian government and the moderate opposition. Those talks on a political transition in Syria bogged down partly due to opposition complaints about the Russian-backed Syria government's bombing of the Syrian city of Aleppo. However, Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, warned against demonizing Syria's president, Bashar al-Assad.
My point is, you should not demonize Assad. You shouldn't demonize anyone except terrorists in Syria. The humanitarian issues must be resolved through cooperation. Mind you, to say unless all humanitarian problems are over, unless violence stops completely, we are not going to negotiate, is a road to nowhere. It's a blunt provocation.
At the same gathering in Munich, British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond said chances of a truce depended on what Russia wants. This is VOA News. The Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev said the strained relationship between his country and the West could be described as a new Cold War. Speaking Saturday at the Munich conference, Medvedev said he sometimes found himself wondering whether this was 2016 or 1962. Medvedev said, almost on an everyday basis, we're called one of the most terrible threats either by NATO as a whole or to Europe or to the United States. NATO's Secretary General Jan Stoltenberg, also in Munich, did not accept the Russian leader's characterization.
NATO does not seek confrontation, and we don't want a new Cold War. At the same time, our response has to be firm. So how do we square the circle? I strongly believe that the answer lies with both more defense and more dialogue. Pursued together, they can help us to achieve greater stability in Europe.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has affirmed the strong bond between the United States and Europe, saying the U.S. has a profound interest in its strength and success as it faces new tensions with Russia and a near unprecedented flood of refugees. Pope Francis has told Mexico's political leaders today that they have a duty to provide their people with security, true justice, and basic services. As he plunged head-on into the drug-inspired violence, corruption, and social ills that are tormenting the country, Francis began his first full day in the country with a winding 9-mile Popemobile ride into the capital's historic center to the delight of tens of thousands of Mexicans, greeting history's first Latin American pope. Despite an exhausting Friday that involved an historic embrace with the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, Francis obliged their demands and stopped to hand out rosaries to the elderly, sick, and disabled who gathered in front of his residence. Air pollution is responsible for more than 5.5 million deaths every year.
A new report concludes that China and India, two of the world's most populous countries, also have the filthiest air in the world. Experts say small particulate matter emitted into the atmosphere in those countries causes a whopping 55% of air pollution deaths worldwide. Dan Greenbaum is president of the Health Effects Institute in Boston, a nonprofit organization that analyzes the health effects from different sources of air pollution.
Living in areas with higher pollution can cause people to have increased heart and lung disease and to die prematurely as a result.
Jessica Berman reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
President Salva Kiir had implemented a lot of areas within the agreement, and one of those areas was in fact to appoint Dr. Riek Machar, because according to the agreement, he is the first vice president designate.
South Sudan President Kiir appoints Riek Machar as first vice president and orders him to return to the capital, Juba, next Friday.
The Electoral Commission came up with that restriction in the last elections in 2010 because of security reasons.
The Uganda police deny report of rising tension and violence ahead of the February 18 general election.
When they attacked the town of Baga, there was my photograph, there was the photograph of a Jammu Haman, there was the photograph of the governor, Awa Fonka Boston. So no, we missed many attacks from the hands of Boko Haram.
And two leading Cameroon reporters share their experiences covering Boko Haram atrocities in Nigeria, Chad and Cameroon. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Sudan, a high-ranking government official says the appointment of Dr. Riek Machar as South Sudan's first vice president demonstrates President Salva Kiir's commitment towards the full implementation of the peace accord signed in Ethiopia to end the country's conflict. Foreign Minister Barnaba Marielle Benjamin says Mr. Kiir asked Machar to report to Juba next Friday. That's when he will be sworn in as part of the process to form a unity transitional government as stipulated in the peace accord. But a spokesman for Machar says he will not return to Juba until the capital is demilitarized. Benjamin told me Machar and his team are to blame for holding up the progress of the implementation of the peace accord.
Really, it is not a sudden appointment. According to the agreement on the resolution of conflict in South Sudan, we are at the implementation stage of this agreement. And President Salva Kiir had implemented a lot of areas within the agreement. And one of those areas was, in fact, to appoint Dr. Riek Machar, because according to the agreement, he is the first vice president designate. So this is a message to the rest of the community, the rest of the world, that the President Salva is committed to implementation of the peace itself. That's why Dr. Riek Machar was appointed according to presidential decree as required of him, of President Salva Kiir as the President of the Republic of South Sudan, to appoint Dr. Riek Machar as the first Vice President of the Republic of South Sudan.
In the press release, he said that Dr. Machar should report within a week, which means this coming Friday for swearing in. Why the haste?
Well, if you are a constitutional post holder, you must be sworn in, which indicates that you have accepted the post. And secondly, you have constitutionally vowed in front of the for Dr. Riek, he's a Christian, you will have to put his hand on the Bible and actually swear to protect the sovereignty of the Republic of South Sudan in front of President Salva Kiir Mayardit, who is the constitutional president of the Republic. So it is a requirement, not only for his post, even other ministers, when they are appointed, you have got to be sworn in. And there's a limited time where you should report in order to pay your allegiance to the country.
Well, the SPLM in opposition are saying that the appointment of Dr. Machar was rushed and did not follow the sequence of the implementation of the peace agreement, and says that if Juba is demilitarized as agreed upon, then he will be ready to do that. Otherwise, it's unlikely he will return. What is your position on that?
I think as far as the demilitarization of Juba is concerned, in fact, the government has been waiting for the SPLM-IO and Riek Machar to send in about 1,500 to be recruited into the Joint Integrated Police with the government police. And also his personal 350 were supposed to be his personal bodyguards. They are also expected to be Juba. The government is waiting for him to send in those people so that they can be trained with the rest of the government protection unit. So really, that is already being done. It is the fact that those things are not in place then it is the delays are from Dr. Riek Machar. And after all, now he is the first vice president of the republic. He can come and oversee those things and become a part of its implementation. Because implementation process is not only by President Salva alone. He should also be in the country so that they can work together in order to implement, because this is peace management, by the way, and it is being managed by everybody. So I think that is not an excuse. Equally, we have the Jamek chair, you know, the former president of Botswana, His Excellency Festus Mohai, is in Juba to see the implementation process. You have all those things are in place. The government has already started moving SPLA troops 25 kilometers outside Juba. On top of this, Dr. Riek Machar has got his advanced team. As I speak to you now, they are in Juba. So there is no reason for any other excuses being given try to delay the process of the implementation of the agreement.
He said in a telephone interview with Sudan Tribune that if the demilitarization is done in a week or 2 weeks, he is ready to attend, but not until then. It appears there is a stalemate here and that he has not spoken with President Kiir since August when they last met. What is the holdup here?
When he comes to Juba and Swazi, they will be able to speak to each other and they will sit there side by side discussing how South Sudan is going to move forward. I think hanging and globetrotting outside there will not help the peace process implementation. We would advise Dr. Riek to immediately come to Juba. His team is in Juba, by the way. As I said, nothing is happening to them. The government has agreed to move troops 25 kilometers outside Juba. We are waiting for him to send in. He's part of the police, the Joint Integrated Police. So he hasn't sent them in. That is the cause of the delay. So if you talk to him again, tell him, send in your police then. Why is police not in Juba when the advanced team is in Juba?
Barnaba Mariel Benjamin is South Sudan's foreign minister. He spoke with me from the Angolan capital, Luanda. Ugandan police have sharply denied local media reports that rising tension in the ongoing presidential campaigns could undermine the country's peace in the run-up to the February 18 general election. This after the Electoral Commission issued a directive banning the use of effigies of the candidate ahead of the election. Officials of the Electoral Commission say there has been a surge in their use by political parties for their campaigns despite a ban imposed by the electoral body in the 2010 general election. Fred Enanga, spokesman for the Uganda police, told me that police officers have launched a nationwide campaign to remove all effigies since, it says, they pose a security threat ahead of the presidential, legislative and local elections.
The Electoral Commission came up with that restriction in the last elections in 2010 because of security reasons. You know, carrying an effigy can also... You could find criminals taking advantage of it. Sometimes when it's being transported on a truck, you cannot know what is hidden inside. So for security purposes, it was found that it was not proper to continue using, displaying on roadsides and verandas, indicating liking for them. And that was then, and we noticed that as we are entering the final push of the campaign, there was increased use display of effigies.
There are concerns that tension is rising since this election or the presidential vote will be the most fiercely contested this year. So the question then is, will the police be ready to ensure a peaceful election next week?
We, as the police, would like to come out and inform the public, the world, that this has been one of the most peaceful electoral campaign periods, where we've had over 900 presidential and parliamentary campaigns taking place. And I must say that it has been one of the most high-tech and at the same time tension-free, because out of 900 campaigns, I have to confirm to you that we've had less than 10 incidents of violence. There was only one very significant incident where they were ugly beating and we had them charged. So from that time up to today, we've not seen a repeat of that conduct. It also enabled us to enhance the security details of the presidential candidates in those respective districts that they were visiting. So I want to tell you that the only difference is that this campaign has been very competitive and it has been very popular, that the public has shown interest and understood the relevance of the vote as far as elections are concerned. You are very well aware that in the region where we are today, it is Uganda and Kampala City which stand out to be one of the peaceful countries and cities in the region. And there is not any place in Uganda that you can fail to go.
There are some volunteers who are being trained, and some people are expressing concern that those volunteers could be used to undermine campaigns of other opponents of the ruling party. What do you say to that?
That is not true, that there is a continued training of militias where each and every political group, apart from the NR, was coming up with a youth and equipping them with tools, with training skills, claiming that they were to be used in the protection of votes and so on. It is something that actually government came out strongly to condemn and prohibit, and all those militias were disbanded, and including one of the Kalangala Action Plan, which was more of tagged to the NRM. All those were disbanded by the police.
One of the leading NRM officials says that they have intelligence that some opposition youth will be coming to the city to cause confusion and chaos and possible violence. What are the police doing about this to prevent any post-election violence?
Yeah, like I indicated to you, Peter, you very well know that the stage we are in is a very crucial one. You need to know that usually in every campaign, you'll find there are certain acts of negative campaigning and data politics done by candidates who are probably behind in the polls. And for this, we do have credible information of plans by individuals who had wanted to promote violence by declaring parallel results to those of the Electoral Commission.
Fred Enanga is the spokesman for the Uganda Police. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. It is just a day until the final round of the Central African Republic's presidential elections for VOA. Nick Long has been following the brief campaign in the capital, Bangui, and in the northern prefecture of Nanagribizi, and files this report.
Sunday's poll is a runoff between the two former prime ministers, Anicet Georges Dologele, who won in the first round with 23% of the votes, and Faustin Archange Touadéra, who came second with 19%. Touadéra's campaign makes much of his record as prime minister between 2008 and 2013, when he is said to have fought corruption and paid salaries regularly. That message resonates with voters like Antoinette Balobo, a petty trader living in a displaced people's camp in Bangui. She says she and her neighbours will vote for Touadéra. He always paid government workers' salaries, she says, and that was good for my business. These villagers in Nanagribizi, a district still plagued by sectarian violence, applaud this speech from a Touadéra campaign worker. Our candidate is poor, says the electioneer. He can't buy your votes, but he knows how you live, and if he's elected, he'll know what to do. Twadera is from a peasant family, he adds. He didn't abandon the Central Africans and live in France during the crisis. Enthusiastic Dolegele supporters have not been so easy to find this past week, although VOA ran into a few in Bangui. Children, do you want to see the candidate? Asks this electioneer. Vote for our candidate. Vote Dolegele, he shouts. The children don't have votes, but this adult said he'd vote for Dolegele. Dolegele paid back debt to the International Monetary Fund, he says, so he deserves to win. Unlike Twadera, Dolegele says nothing in his action plan about his record on corruption while in office. He agreed a political pact last year with former President François Bozizé, which helped him win the first round. But only three of the 29 other candidates in that round have said they'll back Dolegele in the second round, whereas 20 have said they'll back Twadera. Sunday also sees a rerun of elections for the National Assembly, which were held on December the 1st, but the results were cancelled owing to numerous irregularities, including failure to hold the vote in many constituencies owing to a lack of ballot papers. Distributing those ballot papers is a major challenge in a country larger than France with few roads. The UN mission MINUSCA has been flying election material around the country and with the French military mission will be helping provide security. Nick Long for VOA News, Bangui.
Today is World Radio Day 2016 and it's being commemorated February 13 under the theme Radio in Times of Emergencies and Disasters. In honor of the day, we hear from two of Cameroon's leading reporters who share their experiences covering Boko Haram atrocities in Nigeria, Chad and Cameroon. Ebenezer Akanga and Jamo Haman have escaped several attacks by the terrorist group but have continued their reporting despite the danger. For VOA, Moki Edward Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Journalist Jamo Haman of Cameroon's state radio CRTV says he saw more than 20 slain corpses in the Cameroon northern town of Kolofata on the border with Nigeria 4 years ago. It was then he knew he had the duty to let the world know how dangerous the Boko Haram terrorist group was becoming, so world leaders would be impelled to find immediate solutions to save the lives of those dying from barbarism.
Ce qui m'a motivé essentiellement, c'est deux choses: l'esprit républicain et l'esprit citoyen.
He says the Republican and citizenship spirit he has, coupled with the desire to be patriotic for his country and the love of his profession, motivated him to start reporting Boko Haram atrocities. He says anytime he saw fresh corpses and blood and heard sounds of bombings and shootings, he doubted if he would survive, but told himself he would never surrender in his quest to inform the world of Boko Haram atrocities. French-speaking journalist Haman teamed up with his senior colleague Ebenezer Akanga, an English-speaking journalist. In the state broadcaster CRTV where they work, English and French journalists carry out assignments together for their various audiences in the bilingual country. The reporters have narrowly escaped several Boko Haram attacks, including one in which the terrorist group attacked a Chinese road construction company in their presence, but they were saved when the Cameroon military quickly intervened. Akanga says at one moment they were scared they had been declared wanted by the leader of the Boko Haram terrorist group, Abubakar Shekau.
Our photographs were found in the hands by Chadian soldiers when they attacked the town of Baga. There was the photograph of Jamo Haman. There was the photograph of the governor, Awafonko Augustine. So no, we missed many, many attacks from the hands of Boko Haram.
Northern Cameroon-based freelance reporter Aminu Abba says the journalists are his models in conflict, disaster and war reporting.
They have that additional courage that we reporters lack. They go right to the war front to meet the people suffering, to tell their stories. We can call them highly patriotic because they can even give their life for the voices of the voiceless to be heard.
Akanga and Haman have gained the trust and confidence of many Cameroonians who yearn to know how far the government is succeeding with the war it declared against the Nigerian terrorist group 3 years ago. Issa Abdurrahman, a 24-year-old businessman in Kuseri on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria, says it was from Akanga and Haman that he learned 2 years ago his uncle, a clergy and traditional ruler of Fotokol in northern Cameroon, had been kidnapped by Boko Haram fighters.
Je trouve qu'il est vraiment courageux quand je l'écoute comme ça. Ce n'est pas moi seul.
He says Akanga and Haman are the most courageous journalists he has ever known. He says each time the two journalists visit Kuseri, many people come out to see them, and that he believes if they were soldiers, they would have done all it takes to defeat Boko Haram. The two reporters have been sharing their experiences as this year's World Radio Day is commemorated under the theme Radio in Times of Emergencies and Disasters. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Aid agencies are gearing up to help millions of people in southern Africa survive one of the driest years in decades. The agencies report the El Nino weather event is devastating harvest across wide swathes of Zimbabwe, Malawi, Zambia, South Africa, Mozambique, Botswana, and Madagascar. For VOA, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The United Nations reports some 14 million people across southern Africa do not know where their next meal is coming from. It says 2.5 million people are in crisis and require urgent humanitarian assistance. The region is in the grip of an intense drought driven by one of the strongest El Nino climate events of the last 50 years. El Nino produces extreme drought and acute water shortages in some parts of the world, and heavy rainfall and flooding in others. UN agencies report the current rainfall season in southern Africa is the driest in 35 years. Lack of rain has caused long delays in planting and has resulted in a widespread crop failure. World Food Program spokeswoman Bettina Lucia tells VOA people are resorting to coping measures just to survive.
They eat fewer and smaller meals. They take their children out of school so the children can get little jobs and somehow help their families to make some money and try to get some food. They sell off their animals, their livestock, at really low prices. And we've also seen, for example, in Malawi that there are more and more children being admitted to nutrition centers run by aid agencies.
People in Western countries spend on average 15% of their income on food. In developing countries, they typically spend up to 60% of their income. And now, because of the food scarcity, prices are soaring. The UN reports the drought has worsened the situation to such an extent that people can hardly afford to buy even the bare minimum. For example, Lucia says the cost of maize in southern Malawi has gone up by 175%.
So you have poor harvest last year, prospect of a bad harvest this year, and an El Niño lasting into the next year. So the situation is tough.
Lucia says the WFP is pre-positioning food in warehouses so it has a stock on hand to help people who are in their last legs. She says people often are given cash vouchers to buy food if it is available in the market. She says the WFP works with governments to give farmers the tools they need to better withstand crises. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the Uganda presidential elections with Shaka Sali in Uganda and me, Esther Gidu Yuart, as the studio guest host. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa. Thank you.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
From the first time that I set my eyes on you, baby, I was stuck on you. I'm on me, I called for you. Make my body call for you, all for you. Went back inside my dream to search for you. Looking like a dream come true, cause you make my dream come true. Baby, I will stand by you, with you. Cause you are my woman, womanly. Cause you are so woman, woman sweet. Come here, Mr. Roman, romantic. Come on, make you feel good, oh, romantic. Cause you're my woman, womanly. Cause you're so woman, woman sweet. Come here, Mr. Roman, romantic. Come on, make you feel good, oh, romantic. Let me show you,
show them, show them, let's show them, show them, show them, show them. Make we let London know. Make my baby so romantic. Oh yeah, baby, make we show them, show them, let's show them, show them, show them. Make we let London know.
Never mind them, cause they just wanna jealous you. They just wanna be boring, be boring. Cause when you put me plus you, it's gonna be unstoppable. Baby, come on over, got a kiss for you. Waiting on you, waiting on you. You know I know what is good for you. I can make your dreams come true. Boy, I'll be a woman, womanly. I could be a woman, woman sweet. Call you Mr. Roman, romantic. Say you make me feel good, Mr. Romantic. I could be a woman, womanly. I could be a woman, woman sweet. Call you Mr. Roman, romantic. Say you make me feel good, Mr. Romantic.
Time to show you,
well, show them, show them, let's show them, show them, show them. Make me let London know. My baby so romantic. Oh yeah, baby, make me show them, let's show them, you show them.
Yeah, go.
for everyone where they can sing. Now, we don't upgrade the matter. Daily and weekly and monthly and quarter. Now we don't talk to butter. Family to smile and we know get quanta. That we just say Yoruba. Make them no go forget say Badona Baba.
Young D. Every day me paper chasing, so me no care about what them say. Yeah. Ooh. All my people get down, get down on it. Everybody get down, yeah, get down on it. All my people get down, get down on it. Everybody get down, yeah, get down on it. This song is very funny. Back then me I broke, nobody used to love me. Say me I'm nothing, but just no hesitating. I got my mind racing. Every day me paper chasing. The people say me I'm jumping. Right now me and my people we are balling. Yeah. We are go to the club every day and nights we popping. Everybody clubbing. The people them are jumping. Yeah. Oh na na. Yeah, yeah. Now because I'm making money, the people say I join Illuminati. Yeah. But I really don't know. I'm making money. The people say I join Illuminati. Yeah. Well, I don't know what to say. Everybody get down. Get down on it. Everybody get down. Get down on it. All my people get down. Get down on it. Everybody get down. Yeah. Get down. Yeah. See, see. All I want is success. Yeah, yeah. I'm not here to impress anyone. So if you the vex, brother, please no vex. I'm not here to oppress. Sometimes I ask myself, I wonder how I got this far. I'm missing boy, nobody used to care after. Sometimes I ask myself, I wonder how I got this far. I'm the same person, nobody care about. Yeah. Right now I'm making money. Them send me a join Illuminati. Yeah. I don't know. Now I'm making money, they say me a join Illuminati, yeah. I really don't know. All my people get down on it. Everybody get down on it. All my people get down on it. Everybody get down on it. Money, MC me a join Illuminati, yeah. I don't know. Hey, right now I'm making money, then say me a join Illuminati, yeah. I really don't know. All my people get down on it. Everybody get down, yeah, get down on it. All my people get down on it. Everybody get down, yeah, get down. All my people get down. Everybody get down, yeah, get down on it. All my people get down, get down on it. Everybody get down, yeah, get down on it. Get down on it.
Come. girl is such a cutie. You're killing me softly with your beauty. I'm loving your booting. So break up for me like a broomstick. Yeah.
In your mother, mush, mother, mush. Me never for me, they were for me, they got me. They put for me, they were for me, they got me. What? In your mother, mush, mother, mush. Me never wear the queen on the football, they got me. The wear the queen on the football, they got me. What?
I yell, they love me.
From the continent, we hope you enjoyed it. It's time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a pleasure to share my reflections on U.S. policy towards Africa. At the same time, I pay close attention to developments taking place across the continent, listening to African opinions on an attitude towards the United States. These two ways of looking at the Obama administration since he came to the presidency gave me a number of understanding about political evolution in Africa under President Obama. I'm going to identify for the benefit of the audience what I have learned from these last 7+ years. When President Obama was elected, there was a great enthusiasm across the continent. You can summon all your graduate students and bloggers to go ahead and collect all the editorials on the African newspapers, starting from Cairo all the way down to South Africa. In the major cities in South Africa. You can come all the way up to Morocco, coming down by way of Senegal, Sierra Leone, Guinea, Liberia, Ghana, where he visited first upon being elected, back to the other African states in West Africa, such as Benin, Togo, Nigeria, Cameroon, etc., down to South Central Africa, all the way back to South Africa. You can see the editorial. You can have a whole volume of commentaries by Africans on the election of President Obama. This could be a challenge for many professors and their students just to write papers on the election of President Obama. This is number one lesson to be documented, already recorded, on television and in other forms of expression. As we move in the last term of President Obama, we do inventories. Besides the news reports about his election, there should be careful examination of his policies and the manner in which those policies affected African countries. Again, you can go back to square one and fill the blank spaces with new evidence and see what has taken place. This challenge for all of us who are looking at President Obama since he came to the presidency and how U.S. policy was manifested across Africa. You have the second development that is now on the record and is available for scholars to look at. And that is the decisions taken by the president with regard to how U.S. policy is maintained, going back to the false policies of the Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, LBJ, coming all the way to Bush before he assumed the presidency. This has been done by many people who have been looking at U.S. policy towards Africa, and many people have looked at different things regarding to this period. More recently, we have some of our colleagues who have written many books on President Obama. Martin S. Index, Kenneth G. Libertov, and Michael E. O'Hanlon wrote a book called Bending History, Barack Obama's Foreign Policy. If you look at this book, one of many other books that came out of the media since his elections, you can see how Africa is treated and what happened to Africa. I think one of the major highlights with regard to President Obama and those who are going to write the final books, essays, and blogging notes will pay attention to the political journeys of President Obama. His trip to Ghana was much talked about and is very much part of history. But at that moment, many of the points that will reverberate in the firmament of African politics was Obama's perception of African politicking and the manner in which he thought he could add to the dialogue for political change and economic development. And the way it is today, we should share the details with all the bloggers, all the broadcasters, addressing Obama, Africa, and the destiny of political economic development in Africa.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor William Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineers for today, Nick Ivanov and Cassius Martin, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a snake that swallows his friend will have a tail sticking out of his mouth. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Barack Obama recently welcomed Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos to the White House to discuss how the United States can help Colombia seize the opportunity to build a just and lasting peace. In the late 1990s, Colombia was on the verge of becoming a failed state, besieged by financial difficulties, guerrilla movements, and violent drug cartels. But thanks to the efforts of Colombian leaders and citizens, supported by the United States through Plan Colombia, the country now stands poised to usher in an era of peace and reconciliation. Under President Santos, Colombia has reached a pivotal point in the effort to end the war with the rebel group, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, a war that has lasted nearly 50 years. The outlook is promising, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, but the stakes are much too high to take anything for granted. Peace has to be built on a solid foundation, and improvements in maintaining law and order are only a beginning, said Secretary Kerry. With support from the United States, Colombians have been improving governance, strengthening the rule of law, building a more inclusive economy, and extending protections to journalists and to civil society. Just as important, said Secretary Kerry, the government came to terms with the fact that human rights abuses were committed by both guerrillas and government forces, and those responsible must be held accountable. The United States believes that the same comprehensive approach that brought Colombia this far is needed for Colombia to sustain its progress. That's why President Obama announced a successor plan called Peace Colombia. It will support the Colombian government's efforts to consolidate security and counter narcotics gains, establish government presence and economic opportunities in areas vacated by FARC, and provide justice and other services for conflict victims. As part of Peace Colombia, the U.S. and Norway have launched a global demining initiative to help Colombia rid itself of these deadly devices by the year 2021. The U.S. and Norway committed an initial $50 million to this effort. Colombians now have a good reason to dream of a future that is more peaceful and prosperous than at any point in the last half century. In the effort to make that dream a reality, the United States will continue to stand with Colombia as a partner and a friend in the common cause for peace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.